All right, welcome to Story Time with David and Mommy.
But this time with David.
With David, hooray! We love it when David's here. We are reading Kidnapped, Robert Louis Stevenson, Chapter 9, The Man with the Belt of Gold.
The Belt of Gold?
The Belt of Gold.
A Belt of Gold?
Yeah, a Belt of Gold. Huh? More than a week went by in which the ill luck that had hitherto pursued the Covenant upon this voyage grew yet more strongly marked. Some days she made a little way, others she was driven actually back. At last we were beaten so far to the south that we tossed and tacked to and fro the whole time of the ninth day, within sight of Cape Wrath and the wild rocky coast on either hand of it. There followed on that a council of the officers and some decision which I had not rightly understand. Which I did not rightly understand, seeing only the result, that we had made a fair wind of a foul one and were running south. The tenth afternoon there was a falling swell and a thick, wet, white fog that hid one end of the brig from the other. All afternoon, when I went out on deck, I saw officers and men listening hard over the bulwarks for breakers, they said, and though I did not so much as understand the word, I felt danger in the air, and I was excited. Maybe about 10 at night, I was serving Mr. Ryach and the captain at their supper, when the ship struck something with a great sound, and we heard voices singing out. My two masters leapt to their feet. "She's struck! She's struck!" said Mr. Ryach. "No, sir." Let's see. Hang on, Mr. Ryach's voice. "She's struck!" said Mr. Ryach. "No, sir," said the captain. "We've only run a boat down." And they hurried up. The captain was in the right of it. We had run down a boat in the fog, and she had partied in the midst and gone to the bottom with all her crew but one. So they hit another boat by accident, and they sunk her. This man, as I heard afterwards, had been sitting in the stern as a passenger, while the rest were on the benches rowing. At the moment of the blow, the stern had been thrown into the air, and the man, having his hands free, for all he was encumbered with a frieze overcoat that came below his knees, had leapt up and caught hold of the brig's bowsprit. It showed he had much luck and much agility and unusual strength that he should have thus saved himself from a pass. And yet, when the captain brought him into the roundhouse, and I set eyes on him for the first time, he looked as cool as I did. So they were sailing, and they accidentally hit another boat. And there was one guy who he jumped from the boat. So all of the passengers in that other boat sank with the boat, like they all died. But this guy jumped up just as their ship was hitting their boat, and he grabbed onto the bowsprit.
Of the ship?
Mm-hmm, of the ship that Davy's on. And so then they brought him on board. He was smallish in stature, but well set and nimble as a goat. His face was of good open expression, but sunburnt and very dark, and heavily freckled and pitted with smallpox. His eyes were unusually light and had a kind of dancing madness in them that was both engaging and alarming, and when he took off his greatcoat, he laid a pair of fine silver-mounted pistols on the table, and I saw that he was belted with a great sword. His manners, besides, were elegant, and he pledged the captain handsomely. Altogether, I thought of him at first sight that here was a man I would rather call my friend than my enemy. He said that he would much rather be friends with this guy than enemies with this guy. The captain, too, was taking his observations, but rather of the man's clothes than of his person. And to be sure, as soon as he had taken off the greatcoat, he showed forth mighty fine for the roundhouse of a merchant brig, having a hat with feathers, a red waistcoat, breeches of black plush, and a blue coat with silver buttons, and handsome lace, costly clothes, though somewhat spoiled with fog and being slept in.
"I'm vexed, sir, about the boat," says the captain.
"There are some pretty men gone to the bottom," said the stranger, "that I would rather see on dry land again, and half a score of boats."
"Friends of yours?" said Hosian.
"You have none such friends in your country," was the reply. "They would have died for me like dogs."
"Well, sir," said the captain, still watching him, "there are more men in the world than boats to put them in."
"And that's true, too, cried the other, "and you seem to be a gentleman of great penetration."
"I have been in France, sir," said the captain, so that it was plain he meant more by the words than showed upon the face of them.
"Well, sir," said the other, "and so has many a pretty man, for matter of that."
"Oh, no doubt, sir," says the captain, "and fine coats."
"Oho," says the stranger, "and how the wind, is that how the wind sets?" And he laid his hand quickly on his pistol.
"Don't be hasty," said the captain. "Don't do a mischief before you see the need of it. You've a French soldier's coat upon your back and a Scotch tongue in your head." Although I can't do a Scottish accent, and I can barely do an Irish one, so we're going with Irish. "To be sure, but so has many an honest fellow in these days." I can't do a Scottish accent, no. And I can do a sort of Irish accent. It's more of like a leprechaun accent.
Why don't we read this again and ask them when you learn how to
do a Scottish accent?
Yes.
Oh, I've never been able to do a Scottish accent. It's not easy. For me, at least.
"You have a French soldier's coat upon your back and a Scotch tongue in your head, to be sure. But so has many an honest fellow in these days. I dare say none the worse of it."
"So," said the gentleman in a fine coat, "are you of an honest party?" Meaning,
was he a Jacobite? For each side in those sort of civil broils take the name of honesty as its own.
"Why, sir," replied the captain, "I'm a true blue Protestant, and I thank God for it."
It was the first word of any religion I had ever heard from him, but I learned afterwards that he was a great churchgoer while on shore.
"But for all that," says he, "I can be sorry to see another man with his back to the wall."
"Can you so indeed?" asked the Jacobite. "Well, sir, to be quite plain with you, I am one of those honest gentlemen that were in trouble about the years 45 and 46. And to be still quite plain with you, if I'd got into the hands of any of the red-coated gentry, it's like it would go hard with me. Now, sir, I was in France, and there was a French ship cruising here to pick me up, but she give us the go-by in the fog as a wish from my heart you had done yourself. And the best that I can say is this, if you can set me ashore where I was going, I have that upon me will reward you highly for your trouble."
"In France?" says the captain. "No, sir, that I cannot do. But where you come from, we might talk of that."
And then, unhappily, he observed me standing in my corner and packed me off into the galley to get supper for the gentleman. I lost no time, I promise you, and when I came back into the roundhouse, I found the gentleman had taken a money belt from about his waist and poured out a guinea or two upon the table. The captain was looking at the guineas, and then at the belt, and then at the gentleman's face, and I thought he seemed excited.
"Half of it," he cried, "and I'm your man."
The other swept back the guineas into the belt and put it on again under his waistcoat.
"I've told you, sir," said he, "that not one dot of it belongs to me. It belongs to me chieftain."
And here he touched his hat.
"And while I would be but a silly messenger to grudge some of it that the rest might come safe, I should show myself a hound indeed if I brought me own carcass any too dear. 30 guineas on the seaside, or 60 if you set me on the Linny Loch. Take it if you will. If not, you can do your worst."
"Aye," said Hosian, "and if I give ye over to the soldiers?"
"You would make a fool's bargain," said the other. "My chief, let me tell you, sir, is forfeited, like every honest man in Scotland. His estate is in the hands of the man they call King George, and it is his officers that collect the rents, or try to collect them. But for the honour of Scotland and the poor tenant bodies, take a thought upon their chief lying in exile, and this money is a part of that very rent for which King George is looking. Now, sir, you seem to be a man that understands things. Bring this money within the reach of the government, and how much of it'll come to you?"
"Little enough, to be sure," said Hosian. "And then, if they knew, he added dryly. "But I think, if I was to try, that I could hold my tongue about it."
"Aye, but I'll bework you there," cried the gentleman. "Play me false, and I'll play you cunning. If a hand is laid upon me, they shall ken what money it is." Well, returned the captain, what must be must. 60 guineas and done. Here's my hand upon it.
And here's mine, said the other.
And thereupon the captain went out, rather hurriedly, I thought, and left me alone in the roundhouse with the stranger. At that period, so soon after the 45, there were many exiled gentlemen coming back at their peril, at the peril of their lives, either to see their friends or to collect a little money. And as for the Highland chiefs that had been forfeited, it was a common matter of talk how their tenants would stint themselves to send them money, and their clansmen outface the soldiery to get in, and run the gauntlet of our great navy to carry it across. All this I had, of course, heard tell of, and now I had a man under my eyes whose life was forfeit on all these counts, and upon one more, for he was not only a rebel and a smuggler of rents, but had taken service with King Louis of France. And as if all that were not enough, he had a belt full of golden guineas round his loins. Whatever my opinion, I could not look upon such a man without lively interest. So what they're describing is a period of history where England and Scotland, and Ireland too, this is talking about Scotland, was controlled by England. So Scotland is right next to England, and the Scottish, the English king was making all of the men who owned property in Scotland pay him money. And there were English soldiers in Scotland who would make the guys pay them money. So it'd be like if Canada decided that we should pay them money for living here. And Canada's a different country, so that wouldn't be fair. Because we already pay money to live here. Does that make sense, honey?
Yeah.
So he's part of the rebellion against this guy that they picked up as part of the rebellion against the English king to keep him from getting money from the Scottish landowners. So, you're a Jacobite, said I, as I set meat before him.
Hi, he said, beginning to eat, and you, by your long face, should be a Whig.
Whig or Whigamore was the cant name for those who were loyal to King George. Betwixt and between, said I, not to annoy him, for indeed I was as good a Whig as Mr. Campbell could make me.
And that's nothing, said he, but I'm saying, Mr. Betwixt and between, he added, this bottle of yours is dry, and it's hard if I'm to pay 60 guineas and begrudged a dram upon the back of it.
I'll go and ask for the key, said I, and stepped on deck. The fog was as close as ever, but the swell was almost down. They had laid the brig to, not knowing precisely where they were, and the wind, with what little there was of it, was not serving well for their true course. Some of the hands were still hearkening for breakers, but the captain and the two officers were in the waist with their heads together. It struck me, I don't know why, that they were after no good, and the first word I heard as I drew softly near no more than confirmed me. It was Mr. Ryach crying out as if upon a sudden thought.
"Couldn't we while him out of the roundhouse?"
"He's better where he is," returned Hosian. "He hasn't room to use his sword."
"Well, that's true," said Ryach, "but he's hard to come at."
"Hut," said Hosian.
We can get the man and talk, one upon each side, and pin him by the two arms. Or, if that'll not hold, sir, we can make a run by both doors and get him underhand before he has the time to draw.
Do you know what they're talking about? So Hosian and Ryach are talking about attacking the new guy that they brought on board. They're planning how they're going to attack him. Why do you think they want to attack him? Remember what he has around his waist? Gold. I think they want the gold. Remember, you have a napkin on the table there, sweetheart.
It's too
far. No, it's on this side.
Oh, I didn't see it right.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't see it.
At this hearing, I was seized with both fear and anger at these treacherous, greedy, bloody men that I sailed with. My first mind was to run away. My second was bolder. "Captain," said I. "This gentleman is seeking a dram, and the bottle's out. Will you give me the key?" They all started and turned about.
"Why, here's our chance to get the firearms,"
Ryach cried, and then to me, "Hark ye, David," said he, "do ye ken where the pistols are?"
"Aye, aye," put in Hosian. "David kens. David's a good lad. You see, David's my man. Yon wild Highlandman.
There we go. That's an interesting spelling. H-I-E-L-A-N-D-M-A-N-D.
Yon wild Highlandman is a danger to this ship, besides being a rank foe to King George, God bless him."
I had never been so bedavided since I came on board, but I said yes, as if all I heard was quite natural.
"The trouble is," resumed the captain, "that all our firelocks, great and little, are in the roundhouse, under this man's nose, likewise the powder. Now if I, or if one of the officers, was to go and take them, he would fall to thinking. But a lad like you, David, might snap up a horn and a pistol or two without remark. And if you can do it cleverly, I'll bear it in mind when it'll be good for you to have friends. And that's when we come to Carolina."
Here Mr. Ryach whispered to him a little.
"Very right, sir," said the captain, and then to myself, "And you see here, David, yon man has a belt full of gold, and I give you my word that you shall have your fingers in it."
What do you think they're doing?
Try to trick them so they can get all the money.
These are really bad guys. So what they're doing, so they want to get their guns so that they can sneak up on the new guy. And they can attack him. They probably want to kill him and steal his gold. And they're trying to get David to help them. So they're saying that their guns and the powder that they need to be able to use their guns, it's all in the roundhouse where the new guy is. And David was asking for the key to the locker so that he could get out alcohol for the new guy because he wanted to have a drink. And they said, "Oh, hey, this is great. While you're there, grab us some guns and powder. And if you do this," basically they're trying to get him to help them attack this guy and kill him and steal from him. "If you do this, then, you know, you're going to be rewarded. We'll take care of you when we get to the Carolinas where we're supposed to sell you for slavery." That's what they're doing. That's pretty bad. What would you do? You wouldn't? That's really hard.
I would just grab some guns and kill them.
You would join the new guy?
Yeah.
That'd be very brave.
I would not kill the new guy. I would kill everyone but the new guy on the ship.
Well, you know, we don't want to... I know we talk about killing, but we wouldn't actually kill anybody. Unless you were defending yourself and you had to. So here's the problem. They're on the ship. So David is on a ship where he is surrounded by bad guys. He's only one guy, right? There are lots of bad guys. So I would probably be looking for a way to escape. So most of these ships have like lifeboats. They'll have like little dinghies. And that probably would be my best plan. Like I would go into the roundhouse, come up with a plan with the new guy, get the weapons, and then make some sort of distraction so that we could escape with one of the boats and, you know, get away from all these bad guys. Because there are so many of them. It's a ship full of bad guys. That's why it would be very brave if Davy decided to go against them, and very difficult. Does that all make sense, honey?
Yeah.
Because even if he tried to fight all the guys on the ship, there's just so many of them. I don't think he would win.
I think he would just set off a fire.
He could, but then the ship would go down. He's got to have a way off the ship.
Right? He could have dropped it into a dinghy when the fire started.
That's true. Yeah, it's possible. I told him that I would do as he wished, though indeed I had scarce breath to speak with, and upon that he gave me the key of the spirit locker, and I began to go slowly back to the roundhouse. What was I to do? They were dogs and thieves. They had stolen me from my own country. They had killed poor Ransom, and I was to hold the candle to another murder? But then, upon the other hand, there was the fear of death very plain before me, for what could a boy and a man, if they were as brave as lions, do against a whole ship's company? While I was still arguing it back and forth and getting no great clearness, when I came to the roundhouse and saw the Jacobite eating his supper under the lamp, and at that my mind was made up all in a moment. I have no credit by it. It was by no choice of mine, but as by, if by compulsion that I walked right up to the table and put my hand on his shoulder. "Do you want to be killed?" said I. He sprang to his feet and looked a question at me as clear as if he had spoken. "Oh," cried I, "they're all murderers here. It's a ship full of them. They've murdered a boy already, and now it's you."
"Aye, aye," said he, "but they haven't got me yet."
And then, looking at me curiously, "Will you stand with me?"
"That I will," said I. "I am no thief, nor yet murderer. I'll stand by you."
"Why then," said he, "what's your name?"
"David Balfour," said I.
And then, thinking that a man with so fine a coat must like fine people, I added for the first time, "of Shaw's." It never occurred to him to doubt me, for a Highlander is used to see great gentlefolk in great poverty. But as he had no estate of his own, my words nettled a very childish vanity that he had.
"My name is Stuart," he said, drawing himself up. "Hallen Breck, they call me. A king's name is good enough for me, although I bear it plain and have no name of no form. I have the name of no farmidden to cap at the hind end of it."
And having administered this rebuke, as though it were something of a chief importance, he turned to examine our defences. The roundhouse was built very strong to support the breaching of the seas. Of its 5 apertures, only the skylight and the 2 doors were large enough for the passage of a man. The doors, besides, could be drawn close, and they were of stout oak and ran in grooves, and were fitted with hooks to keep them either shut or open as the need arose. The one that was already shut I secured in this fashion, but when I was proceeding to slide to the other, Alan stopped me. So the new guy's name is Alan.
"David," said he.
"Oh, well, that's Alvin. Alvin the treacherous. This is Alan."
"David," said he.
No, it's Alvin the treacherous, honey. Alvin.
"David," said he, "for I cannot bring to mind the name of your landed estate, so I'll make so bold as to call ye David. That door being open is the best part of my defences."
"It would be better yet. It would be yet better shut," says I.
"Not so, David," says he. "You see, I have but one face, but so long as that door is open and me face to it, the best part of my enemies will be in front of me, where I would aye wish them to find me."
Then he gave me a rack of cutlass, of which there were a few besides the firearms, and choosing it with great care, shaking his head and saying that he had never in all his life seen poorer weapons. And next he sat me down at the table with a powder horn, a bag of bullets, and all the pistols which he bade me charge. That means to get them all ready.
"And with that will be better work, let me tell ye," said he, "for a gentleman of decent birth, than scraping plates and racks and drams to a wheen tarry sailors."
So cleaning up plates and serving drinks to sailors. Thereupon he stood in the midst with his face to the door, and drawing his great sword made a trial of the room he had to wield it in.
"It must stick to the point," said he, shaking his head, "and that's a pity, too. It doesn't set my genius, which is all for the upper guard. And now," said he, "do you keep on charging the pistols, and give heed to me."
I told him I would listen closely. My chest was tight, my mouth dry, and the light dark to my eyes. The thought of the numbers that were soon to leap in upon us kept my heart in a flutter, and the sea, which I had heard washing round the brig, and where I thought my dead body would be cast ere the morning, ran in my mind strangely.
"First of all," said he, "how many are against us?"
I reckoned them up. and such was the hurry of my mind I had to cast the numbers twice. 15, said I. Alan whistled. Can you whistle?
I did it one time, but that was in the future.
In the future? Do you know who's really good at whistling? Daddy. He's really good at whistling. I can only whistle a little bit, but Daddy could actually like whistle a song.
Alan whistled. Well, said he, that can't be cured. And now to follow me. It is my part to keep this door where I look for the main battle. In that you have no hand, and mind and dinna fire to this side unless they get me down, for I would rather have 10 foes in front of me than one friend like you cracking pistols at me back. I told him indeed I was no great shot. And that's very bravely said, he cried, in great admiration of my candor. There's many a pretty gentleman that wouldna dare to say it. But then, sir, said I, there is the door behind you, which they may perhaps break in. Hi, said he, now that is part of your work. No sooner the pistol's charged than you must climb up into yon bed where you're handy at the window, and if they lift the hand against the door, you're to shoot. But that's not all. Let's make a bit of a shoulder of you, David. What else have you to guard? There's the skylight, said I. But indeed, Mr. Stewart, I would need to have both eyes upon both sides to keep the two of them, for when my face is at the one, my back is to the other. And that's very true, said Alan. But you have no ears to your head? To be sure, cried I, for I must hear the bursting of the glass. And you have rudiments of sense, said Alan grimly. All right, that's the end of the chapter, chapter 9. So the next is chapter 10, The Siege of the Roundhouse.
Can we pretty, please?
Oh, honey, we have to do our work. I think we should stop there. Well, we have to do our work, sweetheart, and I got to do some work, too, while we're on our break. We'll read more tomorrow, though, okay?
Okay.
Oh, this is a pretty exciting chapter. Wow. You know, I wonder if this has been made into a movie. I'm sure it hasn't been made into a recent movie. It's a pretty exciting book. There's a lot of stuff that's happened. All right. You say bye, podcast listeners?
Bye, podcast listeners.
Bye, podcast adventurers. We'll see you next time for Chapter 10, The Siege of the Roundhouse.